Yes, Massive, we're out of here, we're out of here, we're out of here. It's 5 o'clock, and also, big up to TLC, you know what I'm saying, enough respect for coming through, you know what I'm saying. It's a different flavor, right? We get more of that next week, and more, and more, and more. Enough respect to the item.
Welcome back to Labor Radio. I'm your host, Stefan Doucet, and I'm joined with
Mustafa Henway on this month's edition of Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Yep, you can hear us every third Thursday of the month. Easy to remember. Between 5 and 6 p.m. here and also online at CKUT.ca. You can also find us via our Facebook page. Just search Labor Radio. And you'll find an archive of our shows through that. And we're also distributed through the Labor Radio Podcast Network, where you can find other labor-related podcasts from mostly North America. On today's show, well, it was a pretty special interview that we did last week with Enver Domingo. He's a veteran of the South African anti-apartheid struggle. He was an ANC and SACTU cadre in North America, currently involved in Palestine solidarity work at the ripe old age of 82. And anyways, the interview sort of speaks for itself. This is another one of those discussions where we could have gone a lot longer. But sadly, our show is only 1 hour, so that's all you get. But anyway, so we've talked about this for a while, trying to get someone from the South African anti-apartheid struggle on in order to kind of like explain the way that labor was involved in that struggle to, speak to today's anti-apartheid struggle relating to Palestine. And I think we got kind of a gem of a guest. So really happy to share this interview with you today.
Yeah, no, and also, I mean, the takeaways were really stunning in terms of just how long it took to really to build the momentum, and the tide was against them, but really their strategic outlook in terms of building from below, from just keep organizing until sort of the right moments came. And so, yeah, it was really a special interview.
Yes,
for me.
Definitely. And for me as well. And so we went pretty long with Comrade Enver, and so we don't have much time to introduce it. The whole thing speaks for itself anyhow. The other thing we just wanted to plug is obviously May Day is coming up, May 1st here in Montreal. It's going to start at 5:30 at François Perrault Park in Saint-Michel. So make sure that you come down and join some delegation. Make sure you bring people from your workplace if possible. We'll see you at May Day here in Montreal.
Oh, and after the march, you can also join a friend of the show, Alex Pelchett, who's organizing a special show at Casa del Popolo featuring tons of performances and poets in solidarity with Palestine. That is both to bring cultural and Workers United. So it's going to be happening at Casa del Popolo Wednesday night, starting at, I believe, 8. And I'm sure it's going to go for a while. So you can check that out after the May Day March if you've got the stamina.
No doubt. Okay, well, I guess without further ado, we should get to this interview. This is Enver Domingo, veteran of the South African freedom struggle and currently involved in Palestine solidarity work. Thanks for listening to Labor Radio.
La chanson qui suit est dédiée à toutes les personnes qui sont privées de liberté, notamment surtout nos frères qui vivent en Afrique du Sud. Abba l'apartheid!
We're super happy to have with us Labor Radio, Enver Domingo. He's a veteran of the South African freedom struggle and currently involved in the struggle for free Palestine. And so we have been talking for a while about trying to get someone who is involved in that struggle because of the parallels with the struggle in Palestine. We wanted to have this conversation, and I really can't think of anyone better to have it with than with Comrade Enver. So we're gonna leave it all for the interview. I won't spend too much time on the introduction. Thank you so much for joining us today, Enver.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be invited.
So let's get right into it. Just so people know a little bit about what kind of experience you're drawing on, can you tell us a little bit about what brought you into the struggle and what role you played in it over the years?
Okay, I will be brief on that because of the time constraint. But at a very early age, growing up in South Africa, I remember I must have been about close to, I wasn't even in my teens yet when there was the potato boycott worker strike. The farm workers in South Africa the apartheid system, there were lots of bodies found on the farms. And how this came to light, there was a magazine in South Africa called The Drum, which was black owned. And one of the journalists and the editors was Ruth First, the wife of Joe Slovo. Okay. And then there was a farm worker strike, and a potato boycott was called for. But it was rather a tricky thing because potato was one of the staple diets for most of our people because of the poverty, which was done deliberately as an apartheid policy. So that was one of my first really introductions to the anti-apartheid struggle. And personally, and then there was the one time when a municipal workers' strike in Durban, which is my hometown, was called for. And I was very friendly with one of the municipal workers. And I don't know whether you may have seen footage long ago from one of the anti-apartheid South Africa support groups in Canada, where they showed you that the workers had to run after the garbage trucks with these cans, with these huge drums of garbage, and throw it in. But anyway, a strike was called for, and this person, Johannes Mkhwanazi, he was a bit hesitant. And I said, no. He has this young guy who could have been his son encouraging him to go on strike. Well, I was fortunate in that, even though coming from a discriminated society classified as colored in South Africa, we had a small family business, a clothing business, and proud to say that our clothing business was unionized. Black unions in South Africa, one of the few. And then anyway, Johannes lost his job. And then my father hired him. So that was a good result. So that was one of the introductions to being exposed to the apartheid struggle. And then at that time, I heard about the ANC. I heard about Nelson Mandela. I heard about Chief Albert Luthuli, who was then head of the ANC. So you heard about these iconic figures and you were enthralled by it. And then there would be huge demonstrations nearby at a stadium called Curry's Fountain, and there would be ANC speakers. In the meantime, what happened is that when I matriculated or was entering like more or less university entrance, and I worked in Johannesburg for about a year. And I was employed as a wages clerk by this company just outside of Johannesburg. And it was like a furniture making factory. Well, as you may know, the black people of South Africa, in particular, the majority African population had to carry passbooks, identity books, just like you see like in Palestine, where you have to carry some means of identification. Well, anyway, a worker was not allowed to be in that area if his or her passbook, if they didn't carry this identity document and it was not stamped. Being a wages clerk, it was my duty to stamp these passbooks. And I could see the discrepancies in the wages, okay? And so the ANC had called for a three-day general strike at that time. This was in 1960, okay? Sorry, my memory is a bit short on that. But anyway, so what we did is that the ANC, through various workers' movements, had asked the workers that, listen, we have people organizing, but they don't have a valid passbook. That's what they were called, okay? So I would be stamping, yes, this person works at this company, meantime, he or she was not working. If I was caught, I don't know what would have happened, but it was a flagrant violation of the apartheid laws. Okay, so that more or less introduced me into the African National Congress. Then going back to my hometown in Durban and working in the health center, I saw firsthand the mortality rate of Black children. Over 50% of the children died before they reached the age of 1 year old. Okay? So, and then that's where I would draw comparisons when I see the deliberate policy of Zionism regarding the Palestinian population. But we will come to that later. I'm sure you will ask me. So I wasn't then a member of the trade, of any trade union organization, but I slowly became absorbed into the activities of the African National Congress. Okay. There was no like a card to sign that you're a member. Suddenly you found yourself becoming more and more involved. And I met my sister-in-law's mother, Vera Punin, who was a member of the South African Communist Party, and also her husband, George Punin, who was a trade union activist and a member of the South African Party. But he was banned at the time, and also he was in detention. And I remember my brother coming, would be visiting him, his father-in-law, and his clothing was bloodied. So with the torture, et cetera, that was going on. But that introduced me really into the African National Congress, and in particular, that our struggle was a class struggle. It was the economic exploitation of the apartheid system. So I did do a few activities, underground activities, nothing exciting, but unfortunately, a member of the African National Congress was picked up. He was in exile in Zambia, but for whatever reason, he came across the border and he was captured. And in fact, he was referring to my brother who had to flee to Zambia with his wife, etc. But the family name came out, and then there was an association with that family name and myself, and I then was advised to get out of South Africa. So even though it may be called voluntary exile, I left on that weekend, and the following Monday, the special branch had arrived at my home to pick me up. So I got out just in time. And then from there, in England, I was a member of the African National Congress with the UK mission based in London, and then got involved in anti-apartheid activities. I'll stop there. That'll give you a brief background.
Great. So now, can you talk a little bit about what was the work that you did in Canada with SACTU, and what was SACTU, and sort of what was your relationship with them?
Yeah, well, okay. First of all, as I say, we must, when we think in terms of SACTU, the South African Congress of Trade Unions, which was the first non-racial trade union body established in 1955 in South Africa, but SACTU was also a member of what was called the Congress Alliance. The umbrella was the African National Congress, because SACTU realized that by not participating in the political struggle, you condemning the workers or the trade union movement to uselessness. You cannot have or fight for decent wages if the law of the land says that you are worse than even a second-class citizen, and you are restricted regarding your movements, et cetera, et cetera. So, coming to Canada, there was the African National Congress Canada Mission. No, like SACTU, but it What I need to point out, you being a member of the African National Congress, you were also, there were trade unionists in the African National who were sacked too. So we, it was more or less like, okay, you're a trade unionist, but you belong to the African National Congress and vice versa. Members of the African National Congress would speak regarding trade union activities, okay, approaching trade union bodies, etc. So this was my task primarily in Canada at first, as a member of the African National Congress. And later on, I was a member of the what they call the RPC, which was the Regional Political Committee of the ANC. And I was chairing that and working together with the chief representative of the African National Congress to make sure that when we approached our, you know, what you call it, allies within the labor movement or the anti-apartheid struggle, etc., we were all talking from the same page and we knew what we want. So this helped a great deal. But there was this gap regarding trade union organizations. Now, before I even go into that, I want to say that from, like, first off, we had a lot of support from the United Electrical Workers, okay? And it just so happened that we had worked very closely, or it just so happened that some of the progressive trade union activists were members of the Canadian Communist Party or the Communist Party of Canada. We had no qualms with that at all, because members of the ANC, some of us, well, not me in particular, but were members of the South African Communist Party as well. Okay, so we had no hesitancy in putting forward a sort of workers-oriented trade union body and part of our liberation struggle. So there was no distinction between the two. Then it was decided that, listen, we really need to elevate the trade union struggle in Canada, because we found out that there were two trade union bodies of which SACTU was affiliated to, and that was the World Federation of Trade Unions, which was very class-oriented, and we were like natural allies. Then there was the other trade union body, I think it's called the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, ICFTU. You may correct me on that, but I think that. But they were more or less regarded us with suspicion, the African National Congress, and also SACTU, the South African Congress of Trade Unions. We were labeled communists, okay, because and just like the Zionist entities label anybody who is pro-Palestinian, they use that type of label of anti-Semitism, etc. So you can draw these like parallel. But regardless of that, we pursued, and SACTU decided, okay, we need to have a representative in Canada, and I became that representative, okay? And but there were difficulties, but as I say, we did get support from the United Electrical Workers. And then one of our SACTU representatives came over because I said it would be a good idea to come to Canada and we would meet with the sort of Canadian trade unions. And we then set up a meeting with the Ontario Federation of Labour. And first of all, they were very cagey about us, because first of all, we were WFTU affiliate, but we point out so were we ICFTU. But you could see that their agenda was more or less in line with the foreign policy or the domestic policy of the Canadian government. They did not see the need to support us in that extent, or to boycott South Africa and to sever economic ties, as opposed to the British trade unions, where we succeeded in saying, by working in these industries that support apartheid South Africa, you are complicit. Okay. But eventually it did come about, whereby it was in the 1970s, where it was the International Year of Apartheid. The United Nations had declared that South Africa was an apartheid state, and it was a sort of humanitarian. It was a humanitarian disaster. It was an all. And then the Ontario Federation of Labour recognized the ANC, the African National, and the South African Congress of Trade Union. That was a major, major victory for us. Okay, and this was also due to the hard work of the individual progressive trade unions who we formed natural allies with on that. And then in the end, they even set up a South African Congress of Trade Union sort of strike fund. So which we would be sending monies back home in South Africa. We did not only participate or just like, okay, we're going to deal with the like external trade union bodies, but we were also focused on back home. And what was also very good was that the Canadian, the sort of international longshoremen, they refused to handle goods in South Africa. There was the trade union body that refused, or the trade unions that refused to have anything to do with sending pulp, etc., to South Africa. That was very important. And also the communication workers of Canada sent tape messages to the workers in South Africa. So these were important victories for us, because believe you me, the people back home, as the people in Palestine, would say the same thing. To hear these messages of support is vital. And the fact that it is not just talk, you also walk in it, okay, where you say, no, we want to sever ties with South Africa economically, because these companies that we work with are also complicit. And that is what I really want to emphasize on. I particularly felt that because I was also representing SACTU in the United States. Okay. And in the United States, the issue of the ANC being so-called in the bed with the communists wasn't raised as it was in Canada, surprisingly so. I was expecting a lot of, pushback on that, but I was surprised. But also what it is that I figured that in the United States, especially amongst the black trade unionists and progressive trade union bodies, that the Jim Crow laws, they still remember that, and they could equate that with apartheid South Africa. Okay. Again, it was the United Electrical Workers in the USA that were our steadfast allies, and as well as the coalition of black trade unionists. It was there that you had progressive workers, like in the company for like Polaroid, because Polaroid, even though they weren't physically in South Africa, they were sending material which aided the South African apartheid regime in the sort of passbook that black South Africans had to carry. Okay, so there was this. So these were the initiatives taken by the U.S. trade unionists, and as well, you had the divestment issues. It was very, very big in the USA. We sort of found, and so and it just so happened that the trade unions worked hand in glove with the anti-apartheid support groups. That was very important. And there was one that stands out, which is MAXA, the Madison Area Committee for Southern Africa. And the reason why it stands out for me, because my wife was a member of MAXA. So there you go. I will stop there, and then you can carry on with your questions.
I have a question, Enver. The one, because there's always this conception, I think when we look back towards international solidarity against apartheid, that it was very simple. It's very very clean. It was very, it was moral. It was mainstream. But you talked about actually how challenging it was, especially within the labor movement.
Yes.
And for me, and considering also the Palestinian struggle and how many challenges and barriers we face, what changed? The shift that you talked about from, let's say, Canadian Labor Congress and society more general, seeing the apartheid struggle, anti-apartheid struggles being, communist, and also in terms of the right to armed struggle, the question of also African liberation at that time, to one being an accepted part of the labor movement. And so that shift from sort of the caginess that you described to one of being open. What was it that, was it the objective conditions in South Africa? Was it the work of activists like yourself? Was it a change in the way that it was framed? What was it in that decade or two decades that really shifted the support for the anti-apartheid struggle?
Yeah, no, that's a very important question. And I'm going to put it to you briefly. It's more or less like a combination. We persisted. It was a tough, tough struggle. It wasn't easy, but it was the activity of the people at large. Now, I'm going to talk about, first of all, the UK, okay, whereby there were various anti-apartheid chapters in the UK, okay? But there was one main British anti-apartheid movement, and they worked very closely with us, with the liberation struggle, okay? And what gained sort of momentum was the actual people at large, because the trade union activists were part and parcel of the anti-apartheid support groups. So it was their sort of political savvy of the class struggle, etc., and in combination with our right to defend ourselves, that sort of paved the way to this really broad anti-apartheid movement, because it embraced the cultural sectors, the health sectors, the industries, etc. All of them became more or less, not all, but activists. What we had to contend with was that they were in South Africa, they had what they call the Trade Union Congress of South Africa, or the acronym is TUCSA. And they would send out their union representative, and then what we would then, in those days, called stooges, black stooges, like, for instance, Lucy Mbuvelo, okay? She would go out there and then say, don't cut off ties, economic ties with South Africa, because that would hurt us, the people. The same arguments you will find out with these with these Israeli trade union bodies coming out and saying, don't cut off ties because you're going to hurt the Palestinians, or something like that, to that effect. The same thing we saw in Canada, but if it was due to the work of the anti-apartheid support groups, in the main, it was Canadians concerned about Southern Africa, and they had a lot of trade unionists in that, in their sort of bodies. And they fully understood the class struggle and the struggle for national liberation. And they could expound on that. And so therefore, the education and the politicization of both the trade union movement and his anti-apartheid support group was very, very vital. And we had a lot of sort of dialogue with them, because as a mission in like Canada, we would convey to the anti-apartheid support groups and the trade union what we would like to see. And also what is vital in the trade union or the international solidarity work involving trade unions is that international solidarity is a two-way street. It's not just one way. We don't just expect you to help us. We also recognize the exploitation of the Canadian workers and the other workers. So we were very much in the international solidarity campaigns with workers from other countries. And this is so vital, okay? And this helped break down any concerns, because when I was, say, for instance, in Chicago at that time, and yeah, was I talking about the sort of unlivable conditions of the black workers in South Africa. And I was put up in south side of Chicago, and it was hard to breathe because of the sulfur fumes, etc., from the industries. And it was interesting to note that in the areas, primarily the population were in the main African American and people of, say, Latino descent, Mexican descent, or whatever. So you had this similar sort of environment or policy, and I pointed that out, the conditions that you have. It is because we have the same people exploiting both of us. We had to draw these parallels, and it was very easy. So I hope that sort of helps to explain how we gradually overcame this thing of, well, you know, we still wary of your objectives, okay? And we never chased anybody into the sea, okay?
I wanted to ask you, Enver, a question that's maybe a bit specific, but I think it'll be helpful, because what we're seeing right now is definitely a lot of energy surrounding the question of Palestine, in particular, maybe not in particular, but definitely within the trade union movement. But it's not necessarily translating to very much in practice. There's been some statements by the big unions, but another thing that we're seeing is the Network of Labor for Palestine that's opened new chapters and so on. But again, it's not very focused necessarily, and some of that energy risks being kind of dissipated when people stop paying attention. I want to say not inevitably, but it's definitely likely in the years to come. So What I thought might be useful for people listening would be to hear about some of the specifics of what demands that you were bringing to the Canadian labor movement, how they responded, how it worked out in practice. What were some of the moments that you remember, some particular struggles around particular issues? You mentioned some of them with UE. I think UFCW was refusing to handle South African produce at points, the Longshoremen's Union also. Yeah. But maybe, do you want to talk about maybe some of the meetings that you had, some of the interactions that you had on specific issues over that period of time?
Okay. Yeah, well, we had no issues with the I would call them progressive trade unions, okay? But what it was is that to focus on issues like divestment, that was very important. And the role for us of the trade unions was vital, okay? And the trade unions were part, or some of them joined the various like anti-apartheid support groups, okay? Well, I'm just going to say CCSA at this moment. There was another group called Tickle Sack, but CCSA was very closely aligned to our sort of beliefs or like causes, and it's because they knew the importance of class identity in the struggle. That is so vital to recognize that, that what is happening to the Palestinians today, and it is economic and class exploitation as well. And that has to be recognized. And that's where we gained our support, or we got this momentum going. I can remember when we first approached the Ontario Federation of Labour. I mean, the look that they gave us, because like you were, I don't know whether they thought there were these two communists coming to, I don't know what we were going to do. But we were patient. We listened to them. And, you know, our iconic figure, Mandela, later, he said in his book, The Long Walk to Freedom, he said, you know the enemy or your potential, and you walk along with them. And they get to know you, and you get to know them. So we did not write them off, okay? We knew exactly where they stood and who would they support. But what was interesting, slowly but surely, you saw other trade unions suddenly on your side, because they became educated more so in the class struggle and what it entails. Whatever happens in another country is a direct result of your government's policy and all those monies that are invested in putting down people's struggles, etc., could be utilized to uplift the workers' conditions in their own countries and to draw those parallels. That is so vital, and in particular with the Palestinian struggle, okay? Because you're spending billions, okay? And it's also going to come back to haunt you because, for instance, artificial intelligence that the Israeli industry has developed, you will see your own police force being trained by, and I have no hesitancy in calling Israel a fascist state. That is me personally, okay? I have no hesitancy, and I don't apologize for it. But you will see that. And you see how the police behave over here and the identification technologies, okay? What has to be done here? I don't know if I'm digressing or not, or whether this answers or helps answer this, but what is important is that for the trade unions here, the trade union activists, and you will build on that, to really, really be part and parcel of the Canadian support groups for Palestine. Because what I've noticed is that there are issues, vital issues, like say, for instance, Scotiabank. Okay. They are a lot of monies, workers' monies, their pension plan monies are invested in the Albert systems. Okay. You have seen that. Okay. There is a direct link. What you see being streamlined, the genocide being streamlined, you are complicit in that, whether you like it or not, or whether you know it or not. Okay? The same thing regarding the Royal Bank of Canada, you know, Palantir. Okay? Their drone technologies, et cetera, et cetera. This is all coming back to Canada. They're using the same technology to put down the worker struggle here. So that is what has to come out and to be explained more and more. Take these like actions. I see it more and more in the streets in Europe, etc. They completely say, to hell with what the so-called governments are saying. They are complicit. And it's because of the pressure of the people that the governments are more or less saying, well, we have to think of it again. It is just mealy-mouthed words as we know it, but it's the actions that is so vital. And it's important that the trade unions also walk the talk. Don't just talk about it, okay? And that is what happened to us in South Africa, okay? The people and the trade union, they actually walked the talk. That put the pressure on. That's why Mandela was released, okay? Because they knew that it was not sustainable. And what is happening in Israel and the Zionist entity is not sustainable, despite this horrific genocide that is ongoing. I hope that helps to answer.
I wanted to give a chance to Mustafa, but I know he's at work, so sometimes he can't jump in. But
One question, maybe just jumping over to the now, and for a little bit, is just because you've mentioned it quite a few times, but in terms of maybe the parallels and the differences you see with the Palestinian struggle and the South African struggle, and maybe what are the lessons that have been learned, but what are the things that we should be doing that were effective during the anti-apartheid struggle?
Yeah, well, South Africa was being hit very hard economically, okay? And that was due in the main to pressures from the anti-apartheid movements and the trade union bodies. Divestment really works, okay? And workers making sure that, like, say, the strike actions of the trade unions, we will no longer allow this enterprise to be dealing, say, with like Israel, et cetera, et cetera. This is what needs to be done. These were the actions that helped us. Workers went on strike. They refused to handle South African product. The same thing can be done regarding Israel because it hurts them economically. What also hurts them is to say, we do not entertain the apartheid trade unions, don't even welcome them yet. Have signs saying, no, this is not allowed. Be open about it, be defiant about it, if I can use that word. That has to be done. That has to be yes, one can target politicians, but we need more activists on the ground. You spend a lot of energy targeting an individual, and then the person goes and some other individual replaces them with the same foreign policy outlook of whoever is the Canadian government of the day. It doesn't matter. Where we concentrated on was, you'll have this trade union activist or this anti-apartheid supporter who is progressive, then it increases and increases. It's the pressures then put on, and you then say to whoever who you're going to elect to represent you in the government or government bodies, if you don't do this, this is it. We want to know straight out. But it was the economic, and to make Israel a pariah state. South Africa was considered a pariah state. Okay, it was embarrassing for people who had close ties to South Africa to even go there. It was because of the pressures put on by the anti-apartheid bodies in conjunction with the trade union bodies. Cut off ties. It hurt South Africa economically. It was economics that actually, and the pressures that changed, because South Africans, those who were the like privileged ones or the white South Africans, even they were embarrassed or too shy to say when they went overseas that they were from South Africa. They even said, oh no, we are from Holland, because the language was quite close, or we are from Germany. Okay? So this is what actually happened, and this is where we need the trade union bodies, and I'm not talking about the like trade union body. It is their task as part of workers' solidarity to point out the complicity of the actions of the Canadian companies, which is supported by their government. It has to be done. How that has to be sorted out, I have no idea, because the one thing that I've noticed, which is very difficult to overcome, is to get rid of this guilt that has been transferred onto the Palestinians regarding the Holocaust. That is always sort of waived there, the so-called anti-Semitism. But the only way one can sort of counteract that is to be upfront and challenge them on that, and to educate the fellow trade unions and people in the anti-apartheid support group that what you're doing, because this is how we overcame. We did not say that we were anti-white, okay? Even though the apologists for the apartheid regime said, oh no, these guys are anti-white and they're going to chase the whites into the sea. Well, I mean, for goodness sake, that never ever transpired. And we would, and from the get-go, we said South Africa belongs to everybody who lives in it, black and white. That was in our Freedom Charter.
Well, we might have time for one last question. Do you want to handle it, Moose, or do you want me to do it?
Up to you. Do you have anything burning? I mean, I have a small point, maybe two questions, but I have because this is one of the things about the parallels about how actually this idea that, you know, Israeli exceptionalism, right? And you talked about South Africa becoming a pariah state, but South Africa, much like Israel, was sort of considered this this spear against a sea of black authoritarianism and communism in Southern Africa, the same way Israel's held up to be this shining democracy in a tough neighborhood, quote unquote, as the Israeli leadership says. So this idea that, you know, that, because much of the argument often is that, you know, that that Israel is a strategic ally to the U.S. Yeah. And South African apartheid was also held up as being a strategic ally during the Cold War. So what for you, it became a pariah state. And how? Like,
by the very means that it became a pariah state, because of the broad anti-apartheid movements overseas, they rejected the labeling of their so-called political, they're like politicians or those who may have in the trade union bodies that more or less supported the apartheid South Africa's sort of statement that they were a bulwark against communism, etc. And so it was precisely because of that, the work of the trade union board and the anti-apartheid struggle at large that overcame that. It takes time, but do not be afraid to challenge these sort of narratives. Don't let the apartheid state of Israel to dominate the narrative. This is what actually changes. Okay, when you insist that this is not so, and who can deny what they are seeing? Who can deny that it is there? And you point it out again and again, and you do win over. And Israel today is a pariah state. It's being called an apartheid state. Okay, and even Israeli human rights organizations have said yes, it's an apartheid state. Okay, so that sort of elevates, for lack of a better word, it sort of what you call it, pariah status. Okay. And this is the time to take advantage of it. Okay. As the Zionists use the anti-Semitic weapon as a tool, then we should use the tool of that pariah state and what they are doing. That to me is so important. And that's what we did. After Soweto, what could people do? Okay, we didn't have live streaming in those days, but the youth came out and they told their stories, and the trade union bodies, the progressive ones, with the anti-apartheid support groups, used that. Okay, it was proof, living proof of what South Africa was doing, and it was becoming increasingly harder for the different governments or the industries to actually sort of counteract it, okay? And they became very defensive because you had the people saying, we are going to strike. People in the UK itself saying, no, we're not going to work for an industry that does this, okay? And so that to me is how you overcome this narrative of the Zionists and their supporters.
Well, I mean, thank you so much, Enver. I think it's funny that you mentioned Soweto as a turning point, because I actually was thinking about that earlier in your answer. I was like, I wonder if that's what that felt like. Anyways, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. It's such a privilege to be able to hear your sort of long experience in the movement and impart those lessons to people today who are trying to do, unfortunately, very similar work. So thank you so much again. We really appreciate your time today.
Okay. And just to let you know that I am a member of the Ontario Palestinian Rights Association. Their struggle is our struggle.
Absolutely.
Like your struggle too. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And welcome back to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. On the third Thursday of every month here on Off the Hour. And we were just listening to an incredible, inspiring interview with Comrade Enver Domingo, who was a longtime activist against apartheid in South Africa, both in South Africa and in the diaspora, in exile. Enver just laid out with extreme clarity the kind of movement that was built, the long-term efforts to organize in trade unions and to build that kind of trade union solidarity, and also some of the challenges and lessons as someone who remains active in the struggle against Israeli apartheid. So it was really just an incredible interview.
Yeah, we're so lucky to have had him. Thanks so much for listening. You can find us next month again on the third Thursday, and find us on Facebook if you want to listen again or share with any contacts that you have. So that's it for this month. See you next time.
Les Productions Nuit d'Afrique presents Malian superstar Oumou Sangaré, who has influenced the likes of Beyoncé and Alicia Keys. Oumou Sangaré will perform an exclusive concert at M. Toulouse on April 21st, 2024. Tickets and info at festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Good evening. It's just after 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganiagaha language and Muniang in Anishinaabemowin, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end in English and in French. I'm your host, Sarah Day, live in studio on a rainy Thursday, April the 18th, 2024. Yeah, it's a wet evening in Montreal, but let's stay in dry and cozy as we survey the coming week in theater and in art. On tonight's show, as you probably know, there are some very strong female characters in William Shakespeare's canon, but it's always fascinating to remember that it actually took decades before women could actually take on those roles on stage. Thy Woman's Weeds is a brand new play